Abelard shut off the water flow and pulled back on the spigot, so that monks could run forward with broken chunks of colored glass, which they positioned in the freezing water to create a kaleidoscope of brilliant hues. They stepped back, and Abelard sprayed water again, coating the colored glass chips. As the frozen curtain grew, the studded jewels added rainbows to the city under the overhang. After the ice barrier had been extended another half meter, the abbot of Veritas sounded a gong, calling a halt to the efforts. Abelard shut off the water and sat back, exhausted but proud of what he had accomplished. He stripped off his thick gloves and slapped the padded jacket to break away the crusting of ice. Then he opened his body covering to let out the warm steam sweat and stepped into a portable dining enclosure with clearplaz windows. When several monks arrived to feed the workers, Emmy came up to him carrying a stone bowl of hot soup. Abelard patted the bench beside him, and his wife sat to share lunch with her husband. The broth was delicious. Suddenly, through the dining enclosure, he saw the ice curtain shatter inward with a blaze of lasgun fire. Broken shards crunched to the grotto floor, then slid down the outer cliff. After a second round of weapons fire, a Harkonnen attack craft became visible hovering in front of the overhang, weapons still smoking as it cleared away space so that it could drive under the shelf ceiling. The monks scrambled about, yelling. One dropped a hose, and fresh water gushed across the cold stone floor. Abelard felt sick with a horrible sense of déjà vu. He and Emmy had come to Veritas to lead a life of peace in secret. They wanted no contact with the outside world, especially not with the Harkonnens, especially not with their elder son. The attack craft scraped across the rock floor as it landed. The hatch hissed open, and Glossu Raban was the first out, flanked by soldiers who bristled with weapons. Though none of the monks in Veritas would ever have resorted to violence, not even to defend one of their own, Raban wore his ink-vine whip. "Where is my father?" he demanded, as he led his men toward the dining enclosure. His voice sounded like two rocks crashing together. The intruders ripped the thin plaz door open, allowing a cold wind inside. Abelard stood up, and Emmy grabbed him in a gesture so abrupt that she upended the bowl of hot soup. It tumbled to the polished floor and shattered. Steam rose from the spilled broth into the cold air. "I'm here, son," Abelard said, standing tall. "There's no need to break anything else." His mouth was dry with fear, his throat constricted. The monks backed away, and he was glad the others did not try to speak, because Glossu Raban, his demonic son, had no qualms about opening fire on innocents. The burly man swiveled as if his waist were on ball bearings, his heavy eyebrows furrowed, forming a hood that shadowed his face. He marched forward, fists coiled. "The spice stockpile, what have you done with it? We tortured the people in your fishing village." His eyes danced with pleasure. "Everyone gave your name, and then we tortured some more, just to be sure of the matter." Abelard stepped forward, putting distance between himself and Emmy and the other monks. His gray-blonde hair hung limp over his ears with sweat from his labors. "I used the stockpile to help the people of Lankavile. After all the hurt you've caused, you owe it to them." He had intended to prepare for this eventuality, to set up an effective passive defense system that would protect them from Harkonnen rage. He'd hoped Raban wouldn't notice the missing spice until he'd had a chance to prepare the monks. But he hadn't gotten around to it soon enough. Emmy hurried across the floor, her face flushed, her straight black hair thrown back.
"Stop this! Leave your father alone!"
Raban didn't even turn his head, didn't take his eyes from Abelard's. Instead, he lashed out with one muscular arm and struck his mother squarely in the center of her face. She staggered back, clutching her nose as blood poured between her fingers and down her cheeks.
"How dare you strike your mother?"
"I'll strike whomever I please. You don't seem to understand who has the power here. You don't know how pathetically weak you are."
"I'm ashamed of what you've become."
Abelard spat on the floor in disgust. Raban was unimpressed.
"What have you done with our spice stockpile? Where have you taken it?"
Abelard's eyes flashed fire. For once, Harkonnen money has done some good, and you'll never get it back. Moving with the speed of a viper, Rabban grabbed Abelard's long-fingered hand and yanked it toward him. I'm not going to waste time with you, he said, his voice deep and threatening. With a vicious twist, he snapped Abelard's index finger, breaking it like a dry stick. Then he broke the thumb. Abelard reeled with the pain. Emmy staggered to her feet and screamed. Blood streamed down her mouth and chin. What have you done with the spice? Quickly, efficiently, Rabban broke two fingers on his father's other hand for good measure. Abelard looked at his son, his gaze steady, thrusting away the pain that howled through his broken hands. I distributed all the money through dozens of intermediaries. We spent the credits here on Lankavile. We built new buildings, bought new equipment, purchased food and medical supplies from off-world merchants. We've taken some of our people off-planet to better places. Rabban was incredulous. You spent all of it? There had been enough melange hidden away to finance several large-scale wars. Abelard's laugh was a thin, slightly hysterical sound. 100 solaris here, 1,000 there. Now the steam seemed to boil out of Rabban, deflating him, because he understood that his father undoubtedly could have done exactly as he claimed. If so, the Harkonnen spice hoard was truly gone. Rabban could never retrieve it. Oh, he might squeeze a bit of repayment here and there from the villagers, but he would never reclaim everything they had lost. The tides of rage threatened to burst a blood vessel in Rabban's brain. I'll kill you for this. His voice held a cold tone of absolute certainty. Abelard stared into the wide, hate-filled face of his son, a complete stranger. Despite all Rabban had done, after all the corruption and evil, Abelard still remembered him as a mischievous boy, still remembered when Emmy had held him as a baby. You will not kill me. Abelard's voice was stronger than he imagined it could be. No matter how vile you are, or how many twisted things the Baron has taught you, you cannot commit such a heinous act. I am your own father. You are a human being, not a beast. This triggered the last avalanche of uncontrolled emotions. With both hands, Rabban grasped his father around the throat. Emmy screamed and threw herself at their deranged son. But she might have been a blown leaf. Rabban's powerful hands squeezed and squeezed. Abelard's eyes bulged, and he reached up to fight back with his broken fingers. Rabban's thick lips curved upward in a smile. He crushed Abelard's larynx and snapped his neck. With a frown of disgust, he released his grip and let his father's corpse tumble to the rock floor as the monks and his own mother gasped and screamed. From now on, I shall be called the Beast! Pleased with the new name he had chosen, Rabban signaled for his men to accompany him. Then he strode back to the ships. To keep from dying is not the same as to live, Bene Gesserit saying. Even the dreariest room in Castle Caladan was an improvement over the infirmary, and Leto had been moved to the exquisitely appointed Paulus suite. The change of location, despite its landmines of memory, was meant to help him recover. But every day seemed the same, gray and endless and hopeless. Thousands of messages have come in, my Duke, Jessica said with forced cheer, though her heart ached for him. She used just the slightest hint of manipulative voice. She pointed to cards, letters, and message cubes on a nearby table. Bouquets of fragrant flowers adorned the room, battling the antiseptic odors of medicinals. Some children had drawn pictures for their Duke. Your people grieve with you. Leto didn't respond. He stared ahead, his gray eyes without luster. A white new skin wrap was secured to his forehead, a second application to repair scar tissue. Quick-knit amplifier packs were attached to one shoulder and both of his legs, and an intravenous line dangled from one arm. He noticed none of it. The burned and mangled body of Romber remained connected to a life support pod back in the hospital. The prince still clung to life, though he might have been better off in the morgue. Survival like this was worse than death. At least Victor is at peace. And Kailia, too. He felt only pity for her, sickened at what she had been driven to do. Leto turned his head slightly in Jessica's direction. His face bore an overwhelming sadness. "The medics have done as I commanded? You're certain?" Under Leto's strict orders, his son's recovered corpse had been placed in cryogenic suspension in the morgue. It was a question he asked each day. He seemed to forget the answer. "Yes, my Duke, it has been done." Jessica held up one of the packages from well-wishers, trying to take his mind from the unbearable pain. "This is from a widow on the eastern continent, who writes that her husband was a civil servant in your employ. Look closely at the holophoto. She is holding a plaque you gave her, in honor of her husband's lifelong service to House Atreides. Now her young sons are eager to work for you." Jessica stroked his shoulder, then touched the sensor to shut off the holophoto. "Everyone wants you to get well." Outside on the steep paths and roads leading to Castle Caladan, citizens had come to place candles and flowers along the entire walkway. Mountains of blossoms were piled beneath his windows, so that the heady sweet perfume rose with the sea breezes. People sang where he could hear them. Some played the harp or balisette. Jessica wished Leto could go out and face the well-meaning crowd. She wanted him to sit in his tall ducal chair in the courtyard and hear the people's petitions, their complaints, their praises. He could wear the garments of his duties, looking larger than any normal human, as the old Duke had taught him. Leto needed to distract himself enough to move forward in life again, and perhaps the momentum of day-to-day existence would even begin to heal his shattered heart. The business of leadership. His people needed him. Hearing a shrill cry outside the window, Jessica saw a large seahawk, with tethers dangling from its clawed feet as it spread its red-tinged wings. Below stood a teenage boy holding the tether, looking hopefully up at the tiny castle window. Jessica had seen Leto talking with the young man on occasion, one of the villagers the Duke had befriended. The seahawk flew past Leto's room again, peering inside, as if the bird could serve as eyes for all the concerned people gathered below. The Duke's face sank into deepest melancholy, and Jessica gazed upon him with love. "I can't shelter you from the world, Leto." She had always marveled at his strength of character. Now she worried about the fragility of his spirit. Though stubborn and grim, Duke Leto Atreides no longer had the will to live. This man she admired so much was effectively dead, despite the healing of his body. She couldn't bear to let him give up and die, not only because of her Bene Gesserit mandate to conceive his daughter, but because she longed to see Leto whole and happy again. Silently, she promised to do everything in her power for him. She murmured a Bene Gesserit prayer. "Great Mother, watch over those who are worthy." In the days afterward, she sat and talked with Leto constantly. He responded to Jessica's quiet, undemanding attentions and slowly, gradually, began to improve. Color returned to the Duke's narrow, handsome face. His voice grew stronger, and he began to carry on longer conversations with her. Still, his heart was dead. He knew about Kailia's treachery, the murder of her lady-in-waiting, and how the woman he'd once loved had thrown herself out of a high window. But he could feel no rage toward her, no obsession for revenge, only a sick sadness. The spark of life and passion had gone from his eyes. But Jessica wouldn't give up, and she wouldn't let him do so either. She set up a bird feeder on the balcony outside his window, and Leto often watched the wrens, rock sparrows, and finches. He even named certain birds that came back again and again. For a man who had no Bene Gesserit training, the Duke's ability to distinguish among similar creatures impressed her. One morning, almost a month after the Sky Clipper explosion, he said to Jessica, "I want to see Victor." His voice sounded peculiar, low but emotionally charged. I can face it now. Take me to him, please. They locked gazes. In the wood smoke gray of his eyes, Jessica saw that nothing could dissuade him. Jessica touched his arm.
He is much worse than Romber. You don't have to do this, Leto.
Yes, Jessica. Yes, I do. Down in the vault, Jessica thought the boy's crushed body looked almost peaceful, preserved in its cryogenic case. Perhaps it was because Victor, unlike Romber, was safe in a realm where pain could no longer reach him. Leto opened the door seals and shivered as he reached through the frosty mist. He placed his strong right hand on the boy's wrapped chest. Whatever he said to his dead son, he did so privately, because no words came forth. His lips barely moved. Jessica saw Leto's sorrow. He and Victor could spend no more time together. He would never have a chance to be the father the boy deserved. She placed an arm on Leto's shoulder to comfort him. Her heart raced, and she fought to calm herself, using Bene Gesserit techniques. She was unsuccessful, though. She heard a murmuring and agitation deep within her psyche, in the most distant reaches of her mind. What was it? It couldn't be the echoes of other memory, for she was not yet a reverend mother. But she sensed that the ancient sisters were troubled by something of such grave concern that it transcended normal bounds. What is happening here?
There can be no doubt now, Leto said, as if in a trance. House Atreides is cursed, and has been since the days of Agamemnon.
As she drew Leto reluctantly from the morgue, Jessica needed to reassure him, to tell him he was mistaken. She wanted to remind the Duke of how much his family had accomplished, how greatly he was respected throughout the Imperium. But the words wouldn't come. She had known Romber, Victor, and Kylia. She could not argue with Leto's fears. We are always human and carry the whole burden of being human, Duke Leto Atreides. Wind-blown rain pelted the windows of Leto's room as thoughts battered his mind. A downpour slashed the stone walls, and wind whistled through a poorly sealed window frame. The storm echoed his mood. Alone in the suite, Leto sat shivering in a tall chair that seemed to overwhelm him. Behind closed eyelids, he pictured Victor's face, the boy's black hair and brows, the insatiable curiosity, the quick and generous laughter, the child-sized ducal jacket and overlarge epaulets he'd been wearing at the time of his death. Leto's eyes adjusted to the darkness, and he imagined shadow shapes around the room. Why couldn't I have helped my son? He hung his head and spoke aloud now, conversing with ghosts. If there was the slightest thing I could do for Victor, I would sell every Atreides holding. His grief threatened to overwhelm him. Noises intruded, a pounding at his sealed chamber door that was so loud and heavy, he knew it must be Thufir Hawat. Leto moved slowly, his body aching, without energy. His eyes were red and scratchy. At any other time, he could have summoned enough courtesy to greet his master of assassins. But not now, not so late at night. Hawat opened the door. "My Duke," he said, crossing the room and extending a silvery message cylinder. "This document just arrived at the spaceport." "More condolences. I thought we'd already heard from every house in the Landsraad." Leto could not focus his eyes. "I don't dare hope that this could be good news." "No, my Duke." Hawat's leathery face seemed to sag in on itself. "It is from the Bene Tlelax." He placed the cylinder into Leto's trembling hands. Scowling, Leto broke the seal, then stared at the brief message, wicked in its simplicity, awful in its promises. He had heard of such possibilities, sinister practices that brought a shudder of revulsion to any moral man. If only it could be true. He had avoided even considering the Tlelaxu, but now the vile little gnome men had made their offer directly. Hawat waited, ready to serve his duke, barely concealing his dread. "Thufir,
They have offered to grow a gola of Victor. Bring him back from his dead cells so that he can be alive again. Even the Mentat could not hide his astonishment.
My lord, you must not consider that Tleilaxu could do it, Thufir. I could have my son back.
At what cost? Do they even name their price?
This bears an ill stamp upon it, sir, mark my words. Those loathsome men destroyed Ix. They threatened to kill you during the trial by forfeiture. They have made no secret of their hatred for House Atreides.
Leto stared at the message cylinder. They still believe I fired upon their ships inside the Highliner. Now, thanks to the Bene Gesserit, we know the true perpetrator. We could tell the Tleilaxu about the Harkonnens and their invisible attack ship.
The Mentat stiffened.
My lord, the Bene Gesserit have refused to give us proof. The Tleilaxu will never believe you without evidence.
Leto's voice sounded small and desperate.
But Victor has no other chance.
When it comes to my son, I will deal with anyone, pay any price.
He longed to hear the boy's voice again, to see his smile, to feel the touch of the small hand in his own.
I must remind you that while a golem may be an exact copy in all respects, the new child would have none of Victor's memories, none of his personality.
Even so, would that not be better than having only memories and a corpse?
And this time I will legitimize him and make him my rightful heir.
The thought filled him with sorrow beyond measure. Would a goal of Victor grow up normally? Or would he be tainted by the knowledge of what he was? What if the Bene Tleilax, so skilled in creating twisted mentats, did something to the boy's genetic makeup? A hidden plot to strike back at Duke Atreides through the person he loved most. But Leto would risk even damnation for Victor. He was helpless in the face of the decision. He had no choice.
Awat's voice was gruff and strained.
My lord, as your mentat, and as your friend, I advise you against this rash course of action. It is a trap. You know that Tleilaxu mean to bind you in their poisonous web.
Flinching from residual twinges of pain, Leto stepped closer to the old master of assassins.
Awat backed away when he saw the mad fury in the Duke's reddened eyes. He seemed not to have heard any of the objections.
Thufir, I can entrust this mission to no one but you.
He drew a deep breath. Desperation coursed like flame through his bloodstream.
Contact the Tleilaxu. Inform them I wish...
He could hardly say it.
I wish to learn their terms.
His thin smile sent a shudder down Hawat's back.
Think of it, Thufir. I'll have my son again.
The old warrior placed a sinewy hand on Leto's shoulder.
Rest, my duke, and consider the implications of what you suggest. We dare not bare our throats in such a way to the Bene Tleilax.
Imagine the cost. What will they demand in return?
I advise against this. Such an idea is not possible.
Refusing to be swayed, Leto shouted at him.
I am the Duke of House Atreides. I alone determine what is possible here.
The torment of his shattered life made his mind reel, blurring his concentration. There were dark circles under his eyes.
We are talking about my son, my dead son, and I command you to do as I say.
Make the request of the Tleilaxu. The day of Duncan Idaho's return should have been a cause for great celebration, but the Skyclipper tragedy had cast a pall of sorrow over all of Caladan. At the Calum Municipal Spaceport, a greatly changed Duncan disembarked and breathed deeply of the salty air. He gazed around with sparkling eyes and an eager expression. At the head of an Atreides honor guard, he saw Thufir Hawat in a black uniform coat adorned with military medals, a dressy ambassadorial outfit. Such formality! Red uniformed attendants moved to the ramp door escorting the passengers to processing stations. As Hawat stood at the ramp's edge, he hardly recognized the new arrival. Duncan's youthful black curls had grown thick and coarse, and his smooth complexion was ruddy and tanned. Far more muscular than he had been, the young man moved with athletic grace, and wariness mixed with confidence. Proudly he wore Ganaz khakis and a red bandana. The old Duke's sword hung smartly at his side, a bit more battered but newly polished and sharpened.
Thufir Hawat, you haven't changed at all, you old Mentat.
Duncan hurried forward to clasp the warrior's hand.
You, on the other hand, have changed a great deal, young Idaho. Or should I call you Swordmaster Idaho? I remember the streetwise scamp who threw himself on the mercy of Duke Paulus. I do believe you're a little taller.
And wiser, too, I pray. The Mentat bowed. I am afraid that events here have forced us to defer a welcoming celebration for you. Allow one of my men to accompany you back to the castle. Leto will be cheered to see your face right now. Sergeant Vitt, would you please escort Duncan to the Duke?
Hawat marched past the Swordmaster up the ramp and boarded the shuttle himself, ready to depart for the Highliner in orbit. Seeing the young man's perplexed expression, Hawat realized that Duncan knew nothing about the tragedy yet. He had never met Leto's son either, though undoubtedly he had learned of the boy through correspondence. The Mentat added in the bleakest of tones,
"Sergeant Vitt will explain everything."
The sergeant, a powerfully built man with a chestnut goatee, gave a formal nod.
"I'm afraid this will be the saddest story I have ever told."
Without further explanation, Hawat boarded the shuttle, carrying a satchel of documents from the Duke to the Tlaloxu masters. Sliding his tongue along the inside of his mouth, the Mentat felt a sore area where a minuscule injector had been implanted. The device would emit a tiny but powerful spray burst of antiseptics, antitoxins, and antibiotics with each bite of food he took. He had been ordered to meet face to face with the Tlaloxu, and not even a master of assassins could imagine what sorts of diseases and poisons the hated people might attempt to use on him. Hawat was determined not to let them take advantage of the situation, despite the Duke's rigorous instructions. He disagreed vehemently with Leto's desperate, unwise course of action, but he was honor-bound to do his best. Behind a confinement field in the dungeons of Castle Caladan, Swain Gwar stared into darkness, thinking of other times, other places. Wearing only a thin prison uniform, he shivered in the dank air. Where had his life gone so drastically wrong? He'd struggled so hard to better himself. He'd sworn loyalty to the Duke. He'd loved Victor so much. Seated on his cot, he cradled the hypo-injector in his hand, rubbing a thumb along the cool plaz surface of the handle. The scarred smuggler, Gurney Halleck, had slipped it to him, providing the disgraced guard captain with an easy way out. At any moment, Gwar could inject poison into his bloodstream. If only he had the courage, or the cowardice. In his mind's eye, years melted away as if cut by a laser beam. Gwar remembered growing up in poverty on Calabay, earning money for his mother and two younger sisters by crewing on fishing boats. He had never even known his father. By the age of 13, Gwar had obtained work as a cook's assistant in Castle Caladan, cleaning stoves and storage chambers, mopping floors, scrubbing grease from the oven walls. The chef had been stern but good-hearted, and had helped the young man. When Gwar turned 16, shortly after the old Duke's death, he'd begun training in the House Guard, and rose through the ranks until he became one of Duke Leto's most trusted men. He and Leto were within months of the same age, and through different paths they'd come to love the same woman, Kylia Vernius, and Kylia had ruined them both before plunging to her own death. During Thufir Hawat's deep interrogation, Gwar had offered no excuses. He'd confessed everything, had even searched for additional crimes to increase his own culpability. He'd hammered himself with guilt, hoping either to survive the worst of the pain or die from it at last. Because of his foolishness, he allowed Kylia access to his armory key, enabling Kiara to obtain the explosives. He never plotted to kill the Duke, for he loved him and still did. Then Gurney Halleck had brought him the poison, saying with no sympathy whatsoever, "Take the only course open to you, the course of honor." He left the hypo-injector in Gwar's cell, then departed. Gwar ran a finger along the shaft of the deadly needle. He could prick his finger and end his ruined life. He took a deep breath, closed his eyes. Tears streamed down his cheeks, and he tasted their saltiness. "Swain, wait." Glow strips brightened along the ceiling. Opening his eyes, he saw the sharp needle. His hands were shaking.
Slowly he turns toward the voice. The containment field faded, and Duke Leto Atreides stepped forward, with Halleck close behind, looking unsettled. Guar froze, holding the injector in front of him. The very sight of his Duke, still bandaged, barely recovered from his worst injuries, was nearly enough to strike him dead. Guar sat helpless, ready to accept any punishment Leto decreed. The Duke did the most terrible thing imaginable. He took the injector away. "Swain Guar, you are the most pitiable of men," Leto said in a low voice, as if his own soul had been swept away. "You loved my son and were sworn to protect him. And yet you contributed to Victor's death. You loved Kylea, and thus betrayed me with my own concubine, even as you claimed to love me. Now Kylea is dead, and you can never hope to regain my faith." "Nor do I deserve to." Guar looked into Leto's gray eyes, already feeling the anguish of the deepest hells. "Gurney wants you put to death, but I'm not going to allow that," Leto said, each word like a physical blow. "Swain Guar, I sentence you to live with what you have done." Stunned, the man said nothing for a long moment. Tears poured from his eyes.
"No, my Duke. Please, no."
Gurney Halleck glared at Guar ferociously, dangerously, as Leto spoke. "Swain, I do not believe you will ever betray House Atreides again. But your life in Castle Caladan is over. I will send you into exile. You'll depart with nothing, carrying only your crimes." Spluttering, Halleck could contain himself no longer.
"But, sire, you can't let this traitor live after what he has done. Is that justice?"
Leto gave him a hard, cold look. "Gurney, this is justice in the purest possible sense. And one day my people will realize it, that there was no more fitting punishment." Stricken, Guar slumped back against the cold wall. He drew in a long breath, stifling a moan.
"One day, my lord, they will call you Leto the Just."
No one person can ever know everything that is in the heart of another. We are all face dancers in our souls. Tlaloxu's Secret Handbook. Under the sun of Thalim, the Beni Tlaloc closed off their worlds to outsiders, but allowed select representatives to land in specific quarantined areas, which had been swept clean of sacred objects. As soon as Thufir Hawat departed, the Tlaloxu would disinfect every surface he had touched. The main city of Bandalong was 50 kilometers from the spaceport complex, across a plain that showed no roads or rail lines. As the shuttle descended through the carnelian daytime sky, Hawat studied the huge sprawl and guessed that Bandalong contained millions of people. But the Mentat, an outsider, could never go there. He would attend to his business in one of the approved buildings at the spaceport proper, and then he would return to Caladan. Hawat was one of a dozen passengers aboard the descending craft, half of whom were Tlaloxu. The others appeared to be businessmen coming to purchase biological products such as new eyes, healthy organs, twisted mentats, or even a gola, as Hawat had been commanded to do. When he stepped out onto the platform, a gray-skinned man hurried to intercept him.
"Thufir Hawat? Mentat to the Atreides?"
The gnomish man flashed sharp teeth when he smiled. "I am Wick. Come this way." Without offering a handshake or awaiting a response, Wick curtly led Hawat down a spiraling walkway to a subterranean watercourse, where they boarded an automated boat. Standing on deck, they grasped handrails as the craft sped across the muddy water, leaving a considerable wake behind them. After disembarking, Hawat ducked to follow his guide into a seedy lobby in one of the spaceport's perimeter buildings. Three Tlaloxu men stood talking. Others hurried across the lobby. He saw no women anywhere. A robo-delivery machine, of Ixian manufacture, clanked across the worn and scratched floor, came to a stop in front of Wick. The Tlaloxu man removed a metal cylinder from a tray, handed it to the Mentat.
This is your room key. You must remain in the hotel.
Hawat noted hieroglyphics on the cylinder that he didn't recognize, and a number in Imperial Gaelic.
In 1 hour you will meet the master here.
Wick designated one of the doorways, through which an array of tables could be seen.
If you do not arrive for the meeting, we will send hunters to find you.
Hawat stood stiff and formal, resplendent in his Atreides military regalia.
I will be punctual.
His assigned quarters featured a sagging bed, stained sheets, and vermin droppings on the window sills. With a handheld apparatus, Thufir scanned the room for bugging devices, but found none, which probably only meant they were too subtle for his scanner to detect, or of an esoteric construction. He reported for his meeting 10 minutes early and found the restaurant even filthier than the room. Soiled tablecloths, dirty place settings, streaked glasses. A din of conversation filled the air in a language he didn't understand. Every aspect of this place had been designed to make visitors feel unwelcome, to encourage them to leave as soon as possible. Hawat intended to do just that. Wick emerged from behind a counter and led him to a table beside a wide plaza window. Another diminutive man already sat there, spooning lumpy soup into his mouth. Wearing a red jacket with billowing black pants and sandals, the man looked up without bothering to wipe away the food that dripped from his chin.
"Master Zaf," Wick said, indicating a chair across the small table. "This is Thufir Hawat, a representative from the Atreides, regarding our proposal."
Hawat brushed crumbs from the chair before he sat at a table built too small for a man of his size. He did not allow himself to express any revulsion.
"Especially for our off-world guests, we have prepared a delicious slig chowder," Zaf said.
A mute serving slave arrived with a tureen and ladled soup into a bowl. Another slave slopped bloody slabs onto plates in front of both men. No one bothered to identify the meat. Always security conscious, Hawat glanced around, saw no poison snoopers. His own defenses would have to be sufficient. "I am not particularly hungry, considering the difficult message I carry from my duke." With powerful little hands, Master Zaf set to work on a chunk of the rare steak, stuffing it into his mouth. He made rude noises as he ate, as if trying to offend Hawat. Zaf wiped a sleeve across his chin. With glittering black eyes, he glowered up at the much taller Mentat.
"It is customary to share meals during such negotiations."
He traded his own plate and soup bowl for Hawat's, and began again.
"Eat! Eat!"
Hawat used a knife to cut off a small piece of meat. He ate only as much as politeness required, and felt the implanted mist injector in his mouth doing its work with each bite. He swallowed with difficulty.
"Trading plates is an old tradition," Zaf said. "Our way of checking for poison. In this case you, as the guest, should have insisted on it, not me."
"I will keep that in mind," Hawat responded, then pressed on with his instructions. "We recently received an offer from the Tleilaxu to grow a gola of my duke's son, who was killed in a terrible accident."
Hawat removed a folded document from his jacket pocket, passed it across the table, where it became stained with grease and blood. "Duke Atreides has asked me to inquire as to your terms in the matter." Zaf only half-glanced at the document, then set it aside to concentrate on his steak. He finished as much of the meal as he wanted to eat, then washed it all down with murky liquid from a cup. Grabbing the Atreides document, he rose to his feet.
"Now that we have ascertained your interest, we will determine what we believe will be an acceptable price. Remain in your room, Thufir Hawat, and await our answer."
He leaned close to the still-seated Mentat, and Hawat saw the purest hatred for the Atreides boiling behind the pupils.
"Our services will not come cheap."
We, as humans, tend to make pointless demands of our universe, asking meaningless questions. Too often we make such queries after developing an expertise within a frame of reference which has little or no relationship to the context in which the question is asked. Zensuni observation. In a rare afternoon of relaxation,
while sunning himself on the patio of his Richesian estate, Dr. Wellington Yue's mind remained preoccupied with thoughts of nerve patterns and circuit diagrams. Overhead, the artificial laboratory moon of Corona glided along in low orbit, a bright ornament that crossed the sky twice daily. After the passage of 8 years, Yue had nearly forgotten his unpleasant experiences diagnosing Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. The Souk doctor had accomplished so much in the meantime, and his own researches were far more interesting than a mere disease. Investing the Baron's extravagant payment in laboratory facilities around his new estate on Richese, Yue had made great advances in cyborg development. As soon as he had solved the biological nerve electronic receptor problem, the next steps followed in rapid succession. New techniques, new technologies, and, to the Richesian's delight, new commercial opportunities. Already Premier Ein Kalimar had begun to make tidy profits from the cyborg endeavor, quietly selling Yue's designs for bionic limbs, hands, feet, ears, even optical sensor eyes. It was exactly the boost the failing Richesian economy needed. The grateful Premier had bestowed upon the doctor a stately villa and vast acreage on the lovely Manha Peninsula, along with a full complement of servants. Yue's wife, Wana, enjoyed the home, especially the library and meditation pools, while the doctor himself spent most of his time in the research facilities. After taking a sip of a sweet blossom tea, the mustachioed doctor watched a white and gold ornithopter land on a white expanse of lawn by the water's edge. A man in a trim white suit stepped out and walked up a gentle slope toward him, moving at a good pace despite his advanced years. Sunlight gleamed from golden lapels. Yue rose from his sunning chair and bowed. "To what do I owe the honor of this visit, Premier Kalimar?" Yue's aged body was lean and wiry, his long dark hair bound in a ponytail by a single silver ring. Kalimar took a seat at a nearby shaded table. Listening to recorded birdsong from speakers in the bushes, he waved away a servant who arrived with a tray of drinks. "Dr. Yue, I would like you to consider the Atreides matter and the grievously injured Romber Vernius." Yue stroked his long mustaches. "It is an unfortunate case, most sad from what my wife tells me. Prince Romber's concubine is also a Bene Gesserit like my Wana, and her message sounded quite desperate." "Yes, and perhaps you could help him." Kalimar's eyes sparkled behind his spectacles. "I'm certain it would fetch an extravagant price." Yue resented the request, feeling languid here on his estate, but remembering how much he still wanted to research, how much he had to do. He did not want to move his facilities, especially not to watery Caladan. But he had begun to grow bored in this business park of a planet, with few challenges beyond refining the original work he had commenced years ago. He considered Romber's injuries. "I have never done such a complete replacement on a human body." He ran a thin finger along his purplish lips. "It will be a formidable task, requiring a good deal of my time, perhaps even a permanent assignment to Caladan."